This information is designed to provide accurate and authoritative information with regard to the subject matter covered. It is offered with the understanding that the presenters are not engaged in rendering legal, accounting, or other professional services. If legal advice or other expert advice is required, the services of a competent professional should be sought.
All right, and with that, tonight is creating wealth. So you're all going to learn how to make billions of dollars if you work really hard for 500 years. Just kidding. So this tonight is about this book. How many of you have read this book? Well, you're all in the right place. Now you won't need to read the book. So I guess there's that. James is the only one. Literally no one else has read this book. All right. Well, it's one of the ones we recommend.
Are you recording?
Yeah.
Did you put it on there?
Yes. Okay. Yes, we are recording. So that's what tonight's class is about. It is literally about how Robert Allen defined a strategy, which you'll see is very similar in many ways to Nomad, to make a lot of money and help yourself create wealth. Next week, class on May 1st, is the world's greatest deal analysis spreadsheet unleashed yet again. Bring your laptops. We're going to type Excel formulas. James is shaking his head no. This is basically the spreadsheet that's already available to everyone. Hopefully, you've all downloaded a copy. I will walk through it in detail and explain how to use it. If you don't already know, we will do some live analysis off properties on that are currently for sale and show you exactly what I would do and how I would use the spreadsheet and then when I would go see a property. Hopefully, that will help you analyze deals and answer any of the questions you guys have.
And if I have my wish, there'll be one improvement made between now and then.
Boy, I haven't seen that request ticket come across yet.
I know. We'll talk about it.
Yeah. And then the week after that, how to get your first real estate deal done. James likes to say this is where I teach every class we've ever taught in 2 hours, which is mostly true. The next week, James took one of my bullets and taught a two-hour class on it. So this is it's basically the basics of everything you need to know. And then you can go listen to podcasts on anything that you're like, I don't really understand that part. We have a podcast on it, almost guaranteed. The week after that is James' birthday party. He's turning 75. looks really good for 75, by the way. I didn't put that on there. You know, I can make up any age at any time where you're stuck just to 50 with me. My birthday got canceled, so I didn't even have a birthday this year. It's awesome.
This is technically
I'm
your birthday makeup party.
I'm still 49, apparently.
This is your birthday makeup
this
party.
This is the N. Greg Anniversary Spectacular and your birthday party. So buy James a beer, at least, you know, everyone buy him at least one beer.
That's really funny since I don't drink at all.
Right. So, but there is this bet thing that, you know, that's your retirement, you know, where everybody just buys you a drink or something. I don't know.
To be determined.
Yes. So that will be at, is it at Bad Daddy's?
I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah. So I think that's at Bad Daddy's according to Holly, but I'm not 100% sure. And then the week after that, James, with a little bit of help from me, is interviewing a successful local real estate investor, Mr. S. Anything you want to say about that?
It's going to be amazing, even though I have no idea what's going to be said.
Yeah, and it's not going to be recorded. So if you don't come to the live class, there is no chance you will ever hear it.
There's usually like three or so classes a year that we do that does not get recorded for whatever reason. So
error. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes it's actually technical error, but yes. Then sometimes it's very deliberate. Like we have recordings, but we will not release them. And sometimes it's not even, we don't turn the mics on.
Yep. So there won't be mics on that one. That was a stipulation. So if you want to see this, and I know the person, so I think you should all come. James knows the person as well.
Yeah, it'll be worth coming to.
It'll be worth coming to. And I talked to this person today, and he was like, so I have some things that I definitely have that I think would share a lot of value. And I'm like, just bring them up. So he's already thinking about it and preparing. So that part's awesome. James, you want to take this slide?
Yeah, so there's a podcast. Right now there's like 130 classes or so on there. So it's like 260 hours worth of content. I did just pull down 7 of the classes, and a bunch of them will be removed in the future. So if there's one on there that you've been like, oh, I'll get to it eventually, I would listen to it before it gets removed. I think we're moving to a model where we're going to leave like the last 4 or 6 or 8 up, and then we're going to remove all the old stuff in the library. And we're going to put that into a vault somewhere. So
nice. So I already said this. So the last time I taught this class, I think, or at least the first time I taught this class, was in like the second class we ever had in this room, which was in 2014. And so you'll notice the slide deck is different colors because I didn't change it. This is apparently the slide deck background I used. Beth was like, I like that better. You should keep it. I'm like, all right, there we go. And so the subtitle is How to Retire in 10 Years or So, right? Because this is Robert Allen's plan, is go out, do exactly what he says, and hopefully you'll be able to retire in 10 years. So we're going to analyze whether or not that's true in the second half part of the presentation. The first half, we're going to cover kind of the principles of wealth and some myths and stuff like that. If you have questions along the way, feel free to ask. Introductions we'll do in a second. Please don't take photos of the slides or record audio. If you have a phone or a laptop, take it out, put it on silent now. If it rings, you owe me $10. Recordings are available for clients of James Orr Real Estate Services. And we're going back to basics for tonight. Introduce yourself. What do you do in real estate, or what would you like to do in real estate? And James has the mic, so James, at the risk of you ruining everyone's answer.
I will pass until later on because I do have a tendency to ruin stuff, so here we go.
Pretty sure you're not going to say time, though. So
my name's Kim, and I'm investing in properties in Memphis, Tennessee, and I have a couple rentals here in the Fort Collins area, and I'm not quite sure what I want to do next. But I have some houses in Tennessee if anybody wants to buy one.
I'm John. I'm with Kim.
Awesome.
My name's Kevin, and I'm interested in getting started in wholesaling here in Fort Collins in Denver.
Nice.
I'm Greg. I'd like to do fix and flips.
Awesome.
Hi, Donna, and I'm doing Nomad, and hopefully I can retire in about 6 years.
Oh, so this can be how to retire in 6 years or so.
Hi, I'm Allison, and eventually I want to have a bunch of rental properties.
I'm Joe. Right now I'm doing long-term buy and hold residential and would like to get into multifamily.
I'm Laura. I'm from California. I flipped about 15 properties in California. Now I'm working on my first mobile home flip. That's interesting. Wouldn't advise it. Looking to get back into homes again.
That's interesting. That doesn't sound good.
I'm Ian. I'm a newbie. I'm looking at investing in multifamily.
I'm Lynn, and I'm in a partnership with two other ladies. We just bought a condo. We'll see if we're still friends at the end of the year.
Where are they tonight? Uh-oh. The friendship is already deteriorating because they're not here.
I'm Michelle, and we're currently nomading in long-term buy and hold, basically.
I'm Austin, and with Michelle, and what she said.
I'm Tammy. I'm real estate broker, long-term buy and hold investor, and I am James. Correct myself, is my husband. I get in trouble if I say it the other way. Brian corrects me. I have to take ownership.
I'm Bob, and do whatever Barbara says.
Right now, right? You're on mic right now. All you have to do is you do the dishes and the vacuum, like whatever you want them to do. It's done. It's just on record. Go.
I'm Barbie, and we have some rental properties in Fort Collins.
I'm Laura. I'm a real estate broker and a property manager, and we're doing long-term investments.
I'm Al, long-term.
I'm Don. I've been investing for over 15 years. I'm also your guys' hard money lender.
My name is Emily. I'm a real estate investor. I invest in multifamily. I do hard money lending. I was property managing, but not as much anymore. And I think usually long-term buy and hold.
Where's your other half?
Coaching.
Oh,
soccer.
Nice.
I'm Deb. We do long-term and short-term buy and sell. Possibly looking at maybe flipping some houses outside of Colorado and 6 months at a time, maybe. Warmer weather.
Nice.
My name is Matt. I'm an aspiring buy and hold investor.
Awesome. Welcome.
I'm Bruce. I was also an aspiring investor working on fix and flips at this point.
I'm LaShawna. I've done fix and flips. I'm currently in property management and wanting to do Nomad.
I'm April, and I'm still exploring.
I'm Sean. I'm still exploring too, but I'm a farmer trying to get rid of some acreage once it's not done. Once it's done farming, so.
I'm Lance. I own commercial property and lease commercial property. I'm want to learn how to buy and hold multifamily.
I'm Eric, and I want to do buy and hold Nomad style here soon.
I'm James. I do long-term buy and hold single family in Fort Collins, Northern Colorado, and I do property maintenance and remodel work geared towards this industry.
I'm Kevin, and I'm going to be nomading here pretty soon.
Where's your green name tag? We're like missing two green name tags.
You want to grab the mic? You can go. We miss Denise. And we miss Wes as well.
I'm James Orr. What do I want to do in real estate?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm good. we missed some green name tags. Who's like nomading that doesn't have a green name tag?
Not yet.
Yeah, but you're close enough. And you definitely should have one.
These last three
let's
are all nomads.
Let's swap those out. Here, Denise.
Hi, I'm Denise Malal. I long-term buy and hold in Fort Collins, Greeley, Severance, Northern Colorado.
It's easier to just say Northern Colorado, isn't it? Hey, Wes.
I'm Wes. I'm new. I was here last week, and I'm addicted. So just learning more.
Perfect. What did we do last week?
3K class.
Oh, I'm like, that seems like a month ago. It's a long week, apparently.
A long time ago. Oh my gosh.
How many of you guys, this is your first time in class? Awesome. So we got, it's not your first time in class. LaShawna's pulling my role when you asked that question. So for those of you that don't know me, I'm Brian Williams, long-term buy and hold investor in Northern Colorado. All the cities that Denise named and a couple others, I think. I don't know what she named. Just kind of all over. So tonight, like I said, is about this book, Creating Wealth. One of the quotes that he starts the book with is this one. The trouble with people is not that they don't know, but that they know so much that just ain't so. And this really, it couldn't be more true, especially in the finance world, right? You learn what your parents taught you about finance. They learned from their experience and from their parents and the experience their parents had. And that gets passed down and passed down. And you're going to see why maybe that's not the greatest thing that could happen, right? What happens? We get programmed with misinformation from the time we're born, right? Whether it's your parents, media, the universities. As an example, how many of you ever had a class before high school or through high school that taught you about personal finance? How to use a credit card, how to write a check, right? I'm expanding my age like I used to write checks, right? What's a check? Yeah, my kids are going to be like, what's a checkbook, Brian? They're like, well, those 20 things on my desk, those are checkbooks.
They might even be, what's a credit card? Because they're going to have like phones where they just use that.
I just, it's all on my watch.
Yeah. That's my app.
Yeah, but you learn this stuff from a lot of different sources, right? And some of it is just the common sense. So as an example, my grandparents on my dad's side, they went through the Great Depression, right? They saved every penny they ever came in contact with, right? And that's all they focused on because they had been through this really hard time. What do you think they told their kids to do? Save, never spend a dime. Everything is going to go to crap, right? And so you learn that, right? And this, every period in time in history, whether it's, you know, I'm sure you've heard somebody say, oh, you remember in 2000 when the tech bubble happened in the stock market? Don't buy tech stock, right? Does that necessarily mean that's true? No, right? Like the whole 2008 real estate market crash, should you never buy a home again because the market might crash? Like, these are things that you will hear people say. You'll also hear people say, oh, I had a rental once and it was terrible and I lost a lot of money. Does that mean that's actually how it should work? James says yes. It's hard to let go of these assumptions because you've heard them since you were little. And so tonight, what I'm going to ask you to do is let go of those assumptions, right? Really examine your thinking on this, because if you don't, it's likely going to cost you your financial freedom. And the majority of you are here because you're interested in real estate to the end of being financially free or FIRE. Yeah. So you don't do it when I say it. I have to wait for it.
I'm not sure what's going on there.
James, what's that word that starts with F and ends in E? Yeah. So faulty assumptions about wealth. And again, these are from the book, right? And so while it's not that slide, I know what slide you're thinking of. But there was one slide we taught in a class, and like one of the assumptions, it was from an article. Maybe it is. I don't think it's in here. But it was like, those of you who watch more than 3 hours of TV a day are going to be poor. And like that was the statement. It was just really brash and like straight up forward. But that is not in here. So having a job is good. How many of you believe this? Okay, how many of you have a job that didn't raise your hand? Yeah, exactly. Right? So what do we hear? We hear good job, work hard, right? This is what I was taught when I grew up. Go to school, get a good job, work hard, you know, get a raise, get a promotion, and eventually you'll have enough money to retire. Would you agree that this is generally what is taught in today's society in the U.S.? Yep. Yeah. So it rarely turns out this way, right? You can go and look at all sorts of stats on where is the actual money and wealth divided in the U.S. or how much does a, you know, $1,000 unexpected car bill, what percent of the population does that actually basically destroy? And they actually may get evicted because they can't afford to pay it, because now they can't afford their car getting fixed, they can't get to work, they can't pay their rent. It's like 39%, right? Or some crazy, like it should be like 3%, right? It's like almost half. So like divide the room in half and go, this half, if you had a $1,000 car bill, your life is in the shambles. That's a crazy thought. Our job supports our habits. Like what? Like eating, driving our nice cars, right? Vacations, things that don't return money back to you. So, two statements. Which one sounds more like your job? Wealth is when small efforts produce large results. How many of you feel like that's your job? Describes the job that you currently do. Okay, no one raised their hand. Poverty is when large efforts produce small results. How many of you feel like that is your job? Right? So I would say that 99% of the people or 95% of the people in the room should have their hands up to the second one. Doesn't necessarily mean your poverty level, but it's you are putting in huge, huge effort in your job, and what do you get back? Do you get back the rewards that that company actually reaps? Not in most cases. Right? There are definitely situations where if you are in the right spot and the right time in history and you joined Amazon at the right time and you had stock options, that this may actually be, you may be lucky, right? You just were in the right place at the right time. But barring that, if you are working for someone else, it's really hard to get wealth instead of poverty. Work smarter, not harder, right? So how do you generate cash flow now while you start your 10-year plan, which is the plan that he lays out in the book, which we'll get to. The better goal, in his opinion, and I think in mine and probably James's as well, acquire a generous source of passive income, right? And we'll talk about this a little bit more maybe on the next slide, I'm not sure. But if you think about passive income versus wealth, right? If you had $1 million in the bank, are you happier than if you have $10,000 a month coming in passive income? Who would want $1 million in the bank?
Yeah.
Raise your hand. You want $1 million versus $10,000 a month in passive income? Both's a great answer,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
How many of you would want the 10K? Yeah, so I think taking the 10K there is, you know, what can you do with $1 million? Could you generate 10K a month in income?
Not quickly.
How soon? 10K a month is 120K a year. So are you going to get 12% return on your $1 million? Okay. In real estate, yes, but you're also building equity. You're not getting cash flow, right? A lot of your return in real estate isn't coming. You're not getting 12% cash on cash, not in our market anyway, unless you're like finding a really great deal that I haven't seen in several years. So what are we taught? Like I said, This is my mom speaking directly to me, right? Go to school, study hard, get a good job, right? Yes, of course, that's not a bad thing to do. Work hard, right? And then this was me, right? This is my competitiveness kicking in, right? Work hard, get a promo, buy a house. Except it's more like, work hard, get a promo, then buy a house, right? Get as many of those as you have. And what happens then? You get a raise, you have a kid. You have a kid, I need a bigger house, right? It's fairly standard. Or you have two kids, then you need a bigger house. You raise your kids, what do you want them to do? The same thing that your parents taught you. Did you learn anything about money or wealth? No, not really. You told them, go do the same thing, right? And basically, this rinses and repeats until retirement. And how long is retirement away in this particular case? It's hard to tell. How long? 20 or 30 years. Or 50 or 60, right? I mean, that's the problem. Like, and what does retirement look like, right? Retiring and retiring where it's actually an event, you're like, I'm retired and I'm pretty sure I'm going to be great, is very different than I'm retired and I'm not doing anything today, right? Yeah. Yes. So even those who actually look rich, right, in many cases are not. So for those of you who don't know, I worked at Microsoft for 13 years. And I mean, there was a lot of money at Microsoft in general, especially during the time period when I was there. And there were neighbors that, who you would think, if they drove up, they drive a much nicer car than me, right, my Honda Accord out there, and they would pull up and they wear much nicer clothes, and you would think, oh, that person is doing really well. When in fact, they've already spent the bonus that they haven't even been awarded yet. They've already spent their stock options that they haven't cashed yet, and they don't have any savings in the bank, right? They're basically spending at a rate that's equal to or greater than what they're earning, and they're spending ahead of time. Please don't do that. Unless you want to just live and then drop off the face of the earth when you're done working, I don't know. So, this is the rich dad, poor dad narrative. I pulled this from a different presentation. I'm going to read this just to read it because I'm not sure if you guys can see it. So if you look at the life of the average educated, hardworking person, there's a similar path. The child's born, goes to school. The proud parents are excited because the child excels, gets fair to good grades, and accepted into college. The child graduates, maybe goes on to grad school, and then does exactly as programmed. Looks for a safe, secure job or career. Safe is the key word there. The child finds that job, maybe he's a doctor or a lawyer, joins the army or works for the government. Generally, the child begins to make money. Credit cards start to arrive in mass and the shopping begins if it already hasn't. How many of you remember getting your first credit card? It was like, I can have a credit card? Oh my God, what's the limit? $500? Excellent. Maxed out, right? That's how most kids are learning about credit cards today. They get a credit card, they max it out, and their parents go, what the boop did you just do? Right? How did you ring up $1,500 in 3 weeks? Right? And now you're paying late charges. So, continuing. Having money to burn, the child goes to places where other young people just like them hang out, who were probably raised in exactly the same way. And they meet people, they date, sometimes they get married. Life is wonderful now, because today both men and women work. Two incomes are bliss. They feel successful, their future is bright, and they decide to buy a house, a car, a TV, take vacations, and have children. All things that don't give you a return on your money. Maybe the kids do. The happy bundle arrives. The demand for cash is enormous. The happy couple decides that their careers are vitally important and begin to work harder, seeking promotions and raises. The raises come, and so does another child and the need for a bigger house. They work harder, become better employees, even more dedicated. They go back to school to get more specialized skills so they can earn yet more money. Maybe they take a second job. Their income goes up, but so does the tax bracket they're in and their real estate taxes on their new large home and their Social Security taxes and all the other taxes. They get their large paycheck and wonder where all the money went. How many of you have ever done that? It's like, whoa, what? Where's my money? They buy some mutual funds and buy groceries with their credit card. The children reach 5 or 6 years of age and the need to save for college increases as well as the need to save for retirement. How many of you have felt this pressure? Right? This is common. Right? If you're not raising your hand, good for you. Either you don't have the kids and the college thing, or you're lying. So that happy couple born 35 years ago is now trapped in the rat race. Right? For the rest of their working days, they work for the owners of their company. They don't own it. They work for the government paying taxes and for the bank paying off a mortgage and credit cards. Then Guess what they do? They tell their kids to study hard, get good grades, and find a safe job or career. They haven't learned anything about money, except from those who profit from their naivety and work hard all their lives. The process repeats into another hardworking generation, and this is what the rat race is about. So if you've ever played, I just totally lost the name of the game.
Cash flow.
How many of you played cash flow? And you understand the rat race, right? This basically embodies it. This is what we're trapped in. This is why it's hard for people to understand, how do I get wealthy? How do I actually retire in a way that is meaningful to me? So that plan doesn't work out for most of us, because most people are working longer in life. Retirement savings aren't enough. Our costs continue to go up, so more money is required. So when I was planning this way and it was like, hey, I need to have this big pile of money that I can live off when I retire, right? There's some questions. How long are you going to live? That's a big question, because your financial planner will ask you, how long do you expect to live? What? Like 2,000. I mean, like, I don't know. Like 100? 90? I mean, do we pull out an actuary table and decide? Like, take my blood pressure. Okay, I'm dying at 83. Like, what do you do? How do you decide? And if you pick 90 and you live to 105, holy shit, that's 15 more years, right? And how much money is going to be enough? How can you possibly know this? I mean, if you had $1 billion, is it enough? Probably. But if you had 2.3 million, is it enough? No, probably not. When you choose to retire, right, this is the question I think you should ask yourself. Is it going to be a super stressful event? Like, oh shit, I don't have any money coming in anymore. Or is it going to be like, yeah, let's go have a margarita, I'm retired, right? Is it going to be a relaxing event? So, how many of you like the stock market right now? No. Everyone's like, yay, right? So why does our savings and stock market plan that we've been taught, why doesn't it work? So, $10,000 investment, time on the left, rate of growth across the top. So, if you had $10,000 and you had 40 years, so I'm out of college and I'm 22 and I've got 40, maybe 50 years until I retire, hopefully only 40, and I stick $10,000 in and I earn 5%, I have $70,000 in 40 years. Is that going to help me retire? Probably not. Yeah, for like a couple weeks, right? 40 years from now, right? At 10%, it's much higher, right? I mean, it's approaching 500,000. Is that enough to retire? No. And obviously, hopefully, you're stacking money in here along the way. But this is the point. Like, if you can achieve 20%, look what you can do. 15 million, right? That's a huge difference from 70,000. So in order for you to actually retire wealthy or get wealthy, whether you retire or not, what we need is high rates of growth, right? What's today's savings account getting you? Right, laughable, right? It's like zero. You know, maybe you can find 2% if you, you know, go to a bank online, but they'll only let you deposit $30,000 at 2%, and everything over that's 0.1%, right? And then you open 5 accounts there, and I know someone who's done this. So... And I'm like, and then they cut them off at 5 accounts. They're like, we noticed you have 5 accounts with us trying to get 2%. So average inflation by decade, right? I'm not going to go through all this. Long-term average from 1913 to 2013, 3.21%. Do you have a more recent number than that?
No, actually, that's still pretty close.
Yeah, so I mean, it's been about in that range. We call it about 3%. So if you look at that, right, if you're earning 5% and inflation's 3%, what are you really making? Not much. Right, that's the answer. And this is not adjusted for inflation, which is crazy. So, I mean, this is not worth a lot in 40 years. So, for those of you who like the stock market, here's some data. Dow Jones from 1896 to 2019, 5.346% return. 2.236 if you adjust for inflation. You're like, oh, I wasn't alive in 1896, Brian. Who cares, right? Sure. So, 6.6% stock market return overall from 1802 to 2012. Fine, I get it. You weren't born then either. S&P 500, this is inflation adjusted. So, there's a calculator out there that basically lets you run, hey, I want to get a 5% return across 40 years. and it looks at all the data, and it basically goes, how likely is that through all of the data for the S&P 500 since the beginning of time? 5% return, 87.4% likely. That's not too bad if you want a 5% return, but we've just decided we want more than a 5% return. How about 7? Wow. Suddenly our numbers just drops. 33% likely. 10%, less than 1% chance.
And to clarify, that is 5% or better, or 7% or better, or 10% or better.
Correct.
It's not exactly 5%.
Correct. Yes. This is 5% return, so this 87.4 includes all of this. This 7% includes this. But 10%, right? You ask a lot of people, hey, what kind of return can you get in the stock market? You'll hear 8%, 10% a lot. I think James used 8% or 10% in one of his presentations, right? 10%, less than 1% chance. You want to risk your retirement on that? I don't. S&P 500 inflation adjusted from 1979, so this is the last 40 years, 5%. So great. You stuck your money in 1979, and you basically got 5% per year. Whatever you stuck in, it turned from that 10,000 into the 70,000 that we saw on the previous chart, if you stuck 10,000 in. 7.86 if you reinvest your dividends. That's better. It's still only 7%, though, 8%. So your 10K investment with this is now 261,000. So it's not bad, but it's not great. You can't retire on that. Or it's 70K, like we said earlier, if you adjust for inflation. There's those two charts again. Any questions on that? Does that shock anyone? Because you're all like, yeah, I've been getting 25% a year for the last 5 years in the stock market. Seems amazing, right? There's another stat that basically shows if you missed, and this doesn't include the last 5 years, but if you missed like the best 11 days in the last 100 years of the market, your return is like paltry in comparison to what it could have been. It's literally, you have to be in the market during those times. So, mindset. How do we think about our mindset? Poor Dad versus Rich Dad. How many of you have read Rich Dad, Poor Dad? Perfect. How many of you read this book? Dang, we're teaching the wrong class, I guess. Or maybe we're teaching the right class. No one's read it. So, I can't afford it versus how can I afford it, right? The first one is just an excuse of, I can't figure out how to make this happen, I quit. The second one is the Rich Dad, right? How do we think critically about getting what we want? And then go and take action on it. Study hard so you can work for a good company. What do you think the Rich Dad would say? Study hard so that you can buy a good company, right? Or own a good company. Exactly. Play it safe with money. Don't take risks. What do you think the Rich Dad would say? Yeah, learn to manage those risks, right? Go out and take the risks. Without those risks, it's likely you're not going to make a lot of money. My home is my largest investment and greatest asset. How many of your parents believed this? Right? Like 100% of, my family, that's like what they believe. I own this house, and then I buy a bigger house, and that's my largest asset. What does the Rich Dad think? Yeah, you're in a whole lot of trouble if you think that this is true. So, that's just some mindset. Saving money is a good investment. Agree or disagree? Not just because you're in this class. Honestly. Saving money is good or bad?
Good.
Yeah. Everyone's like scared to say it's good. Because then Brian's going to click the clicker and be like, that's all wrong. No.
Saving money is just spending less than you make.
Yes, which if everyone did that, everyone would not have as many problems. Yes. So, how many millionaires got rich that you personally know through savings accounts? Yeah, Zippo, right? So that should tell you something. This is that thing where, my mom, back in my old day, when I was, a youngster, since James thinks I'm 50, and I lived in a small town in Iowa, and I had like a written savings ledger, and you would take it in, you would give them like $10. They would write it down in the book and initial it and hand it back to you. And I'm like,
it's a passbook.
For real? Like, What if I just initial that? I'm like, how much fraud actually occurred during those days? I'm sure they tracked it internally, too.
Did they use their abacus to make sure that you
Yeah. Yeah. So not many, but that's what we were taught, right? Go save your money, save 10%, save whatever, right? Savings accounts, CDs. When I was, I don't know, how old would I have been? 10? 1985, 86, somewhere in there, when interest rates for homes were like at 18 and 22, CDs were at 8%. I was like, baller, put all my money in a 5-year CD and let it ride, right? In hindsight, I mean, as a kid, there's not a lot else I could have done, right? But as an adult, there's a lot of adults going, yeah, 8% is awesome. And it is pretty awesome. But it's not going to get you anywhere. And now, you know, when they come back down and they're 1% or 2%, you're not even keeping up with inflation. So if you're earning about less than 10% a year, Robert Allen's claim is that you're essentially losing money after inflation and taxes, which for the most part, I agree with. So if you're thinking, yeah, I'm getting 5 or 6 or 8% in the stock market, great until you read this. Right? And then maybe not so much. So how safe does that feel? You know, if your savings account, instead of being measured in today's dollars, like, hey, I have $1,000 and I got my interest, now I have $1,100. If it was measured in like when you put the money in and it was like $1,000, and the next year it was like $900, and then it was $800, maybe you wouldn't feel so good about it, right? It's like, hey, my money's growing, but is it growing fast enough? I think that's the point. Saving is definitely important. I don't want to take away from that. And it takes discipline to save. It takes discipline to spend less than you earn. Start there, right? You've got to save in order to be able to invest. Move your savings into investments that are going to have wealth-producing returns, 20% plus. How many of you believe in real estate it's possible to get 20% plus on your money? How many of you do not believe that? How many of you just don't raise your hands when I ask questions? This whole back section, you guys all sat together on purpose or something. Yeah. So, debt is bad. True statement?
No.
Certain debt is bad. Yeah, I would agree with that. But debt is terrifying. If you ask my, if I told my mom how much real estate debt I would have, she actually might die. Like, just, she's like, she, right? Because, I mean, she lives in a time in, you know, small town Iowa where a $70,000 house is normal, right? Whereas, you know, the first house I ever bought to live in the Seattle area was $250,000, and I called her and told her, and she literally almost died then, right? So I think debt is terrifying for most people, right? Now, what kind of debt are we going to avoid? Buying cars, right? Buying TVs, putting stuff on layaway, all the stuff that we're like, oh, I need that right now, but you don't. Delay your gratification. Damn, what are you guys buying?
Is still a thing.
Oh, it is.
Really?
Walmart brought it back hardcore last Christmas. Yeah, and lots of people were laying away a lot of stuff.
Actually, there was someone famous who went in and paid off all the layaway stuff for people.
Shaq. Was it Shaq?
I thought it was Kid Rock.
Somebody like that. Yeah. He basically went into a Walmart and was just like, I'm going to pay off everybody's layaway.
Yeah.
It might be Shaq that has the largest single purchase at Walmart ever.
Oh.
It was like $66,000. He literally moved to a new town and outfitted his house from Walmart, which I then thought to myself, is that real? Shaq outfitted his house from Walmart? Come on. So borrowing money to buy appearances of wealth. This is exactly what many people at Microsoft would do. They would, hey, I've got all this money on paper and stock options. I'm going to buy a nice car, and then I'm going to buy a nicer car and a nicer house. How far did this get them? Not very far, because what happens when you drive that car off the lot? Yeah, it loses like a third to half of its value, depending on who you ask, right? And by the time you get that debt paid off, what's it usually worth? Nothing, right? This sucks. So, yeah. You can never become wealthy. Again, this is Robert Allen. You can never become wealthy without going into some form of investment debt. And unless your version of get wealthy is have a parent hand you enough money that you consider yourself wealthy, I probably agree with this statement. James, do you agree with that statement? Since you're the anti, well, I mean, not anti, but You're very not debt like I am.
It is a lot easier to do it if you're willing to take on some debt.
And likely a lot faster. Tammy's nodding. We're going to take that as a yes from James. And probably a lot of debt. So if you're scared of good debt, getting wealthy may actually be very difficult. Right? Leverage allows you to compound your growth. Security is good. Society is obsessed with security. I like my job. It's safe. How many of you have ever... I probably can't ask that question. I was going to ask, how many people have ever been fired or laid off? Don't raise your hands. How many of you know someone who has been fired or laid off from their job who thought they had a really safe job? And then suddenly they were replaced. And what happened? They thought, oh, the company will never survive without me, right? And then you leave, and it's just like nothing happened, right? Someone else steps in, does your job, and maybe not nearly as good as you did or your friend did, but it happens, right? Social Security. How many of you are confident that when you retire, Social Security will be here? We have one.
I'm old enough that it'll still be here. It may not be any good.
Let's not. Right? FDIC, right? Hey, you put your money in a bank, it's totally insured. Is it?
No.
Not really. There, if you actually go and read, it's like you like are covered up to $100,000, but there's like no repayment timeline on that. Like, we'll get your money back when we get your money back. Like, it's crazy. Security is only an illusion. Just talked about that. Savings account, same way. We talked about the money constantly declining if you're not making a high enough rate of return. Security doesn't really exist. It's a made-up thing in our head. My job's secure. I have secure income, right? There are definitely some jobs that are more secure than others, but it's just risk. How much risk are you willing to take? So if you're not willing to take a lot of risk, or at least good risk that you've evaluated using an amazing spreadsheet that we'll teach you next week, just kidding. It's like suddenly I'm a salesperson. More security equals avoiding risk. Less security equals the chance to actually build and grow your wealth. When you are focused on security, and I will admit, I am definitely was focused on security for a really long time. Although if you looked at what I did, it may not have emulated that, but I thought, right, hey, yes, owning nothing but Microsoft stock in the stock market is totally secure. I work here, it's gonna always do really well, until it doesn't. But this leads to missed opportunities, right? Are you gonna hit a home run every time you buy a house? No. But if you hit a bunch of singles and doubles, right? Is that okay? Yeah. Does that get you where you need to go? Probably. Risk is an essential part of progress, and this is your comfort zone, right? So when you're like, oh man, I really want to buy that first property, but I'm not ready. Push outside the comfort zone, right? You're here in class, get ready and do it. Learn to view this as a positive. Risk doesn't have to be a negative. You can look at that and go, hey, there's some risk there, but I've evaluated. I'm going to manage the risk because I'm in control of it, especially in real estate, and help yourself build wealth. Failure is bad. How many of you agree with this? No one's raising the... Joe! Joe gets a high five for raising his hand, the only one. So failure is bad. Do you like to fail?
No.
How, why not? Because it hurts. Because it sucks. Because you lose money, because you get hurt, right? But failure is a part of success. Like, there's no one who is super successful that didn't fail along the way. And when they failed, what did they do? They learned, right? So change your attitude in your head about failure, right? This is what I try and teach my kids. It's like, when something doesn't go the way you want it, how can you make it different the next time, right? Learn from that experience. Don't repeat it. Find new solutions. All successful people are failing on their way to the top. What people don't realize is that successful people keep going. I'm sure you've seen that little like chart of the miner, and there's a bunch of rocks here, and he's got his pickaxe, and like the diamond is right here. And this guy, like, he's got that much of the wall left, and he's just like, I quit, right? Where the other guy, you know, he hits it a few more times, and he gets to the diamond, right? That's what this is. And especially, you're going to see this later, that in real estate, and especially his plan, if you quit early, you lose, right? You have to stick it out. Wealth is measured in possessions. Maybe. Wealth is not money. Money is simply the appearance of wealth. Wealth can mean many things to many people, and in many cases, wealth is thoughts, not things. Right? Are you wealthy based on how much money you have, or are you wealthy based on your ability to actually produce that money again and again and again and again if you had to? Right? If you took everything away from someone that has a wealthy state of mind, could they get it back? Are they suddenly going to think of themselves, oh, I'm poor, I have no money? No. They're going to be like, okay, fine, you took it, that was a failure, I'm going to learn from that, and I'm going to go rebuild my wealth. Right? There's a... What's that? Yeah. So Henry Ford was asked this very question. He's like, what would you do if everything that you had was just taken away? He'd be like, I'd be right back where I was in 5 years. Right? It's a state of mind. Being wealthy is a state of mind. James, you have something?
No.
Everyone's noticing whatever you just ate out of aluminum foil, which looked weird. So, broke is a temporary condition, poor is a state of mind. I just gave you the Henry Ford example, right? Have that positive mindset that you can recreate what you've built again and again and again. Another kind of one of the false beliefs, someone else is responsible for my financial well-being. When whoever you believe showed up at America First showed up, right? We don't do politics in this room. We don't even do history. Yeah. James, who showed up first? See? You don't want to answer this. What?
Vikings.
The Vikings. So in James's version of history, when the Vikings showed up in America first, do you think they were like, hey, the government has my back. They're going to take care of me. No, wait. They were like, we're going to have to bust our ass in order to survive.
I take that back. Native Americans probably were there before.
Thank you. Right? But historically, there was no welfare system. There was no unemployment. You, like, had the opportunity to go make something great, and that's what you had to do. Right? Today, it's more like government, employers, someone else. If I get sick, somebody's going to take care of me. Right? People have really stopped assuming responsibility for their own well-being. You see this all the time. This is pretty destructive, right? Someone else will fix this. Someone else will take care of this. Instead of, hey, that's broken. I'm going to go fix it in all sorts of places. If you adopt this line of thinking that you are responsible for your own financial well-being and welfare, you will fare much better than probably 99.9% of the people. Acquiring wealth is a win-lose game. This is a huge one. And I think there are people in this room, whether they admit it or not, that actually believe this today. Lots of people believe this, right? Hey, Tammy has a lot of money, but therefore Denise doesn't have as much as she could, right? Hey, we're going after the same deal, and I got the deal, therefore, like, I won and you lost, right? And it may be in that particular deal, like, I beat you to the punch and I got the deal, or you beat me to the punch, but that's not how it really works, right? People think, hey, you got rich, something dirty must be going on. And I'm sure there are some cases where this is true. Again, we don't do politics here. Wealth acquired, taking advantage of others, right? Hey, I'm wealthy and I'm taking advantage of people. People do this with lease options, right? I have a house, I'm going to lease option it to you, and I know you're not going to exercise, but I'm going to take your lease option fee, and I'm going to keep it, and I'm going to just do this over and over and over. That is not what we do here, right? That's immoral, unethical, could even be illegal. What we're after is creating win-win wealth, right? There's an infinite source of wealth. Just because someone else's pile is bigger than your pile doesn't mean that you are at a loss because of them, right? It's not like, oh, there's only $200 trillion in the world and you've got to scoop as much as you can now or you're screwed. That's just not how it works. Is that clear to everybody? I want to make sure I did. Is that clear, James?
Yes, it's clear to me.
Okay. It takes money to make money. How many of you believe this?
It helps.
Definitely helps. I think it takes money to make money. I think the key thing about this is that it doesn't have to be your money, right? You can borrow someone's money. You can partner with someone to help make money. The clicker is dying. Borrowing and leverage lead to wealth. Right? Start now and be there in 10 years. Again, this is the plan. We're going to get to the 10-year plan shortly. So here's the false assumptions about wealth that we just covered. Anyone have any questions on any of those or thoughts? or you're like, hey, that one's crap, I don't buy it. All right. You get the microphone.
I feel like some of the thoughts that you shared are generational, and maybe not, like maybe our parents believed that, but not our generation or our kids.
Like what? Give me an example.
That debt is bad, for example. I don't think debt is bad. Some is, but I'm not going to encourage my kids to go into debt, and my parents would definitely, my mom would die if she knew my debt.
Right.
So,
but you just said you're not going to encourage your kids to go into debt?
Not. Well, you're right, but not.
So you just lived up to what your parents told you to do.
Yeah.
I
think there are some guidelines that you need to provide, and I think that my attitude is different than my parents, and I'm.
No doubt. So the thing is, and this is where things get tricky, right? And if you think about the guidelines that you're likely to provide, what are those guidelines based on? They're based on your experience, right? They're not based on like a wealth of knowledge of what actually got people wealthy. It's based on your experience. And so if you are super wealthy, then fantastic. Totally pass that knowledge on. But if you're not and you are like, I want my kids to do better, have them go find out where the wealthy people got wealthy and follow those, right? And it's really hard because as a parent, you want to be like, I did this, so you should do this, right? I mean, this is why we have like father and son companies and father and daughter companies, right? Because you're like, I'm in real estate, you should be in real estate. I mean, I'm in carpentry, you should be. This is all over. But it's hard, right? I mean, my kids don't understand because they're not old. They're 8, 10, and 12, so they don't really understand. They understand rental stuff in general, but they don't understand the debt side yet. But at some point, you know, it's like, hey, this is why I did it. Here's some books, right? You should read some books. You should talk to some other people because otherwise we're just passing along what we believe to be true and right, even though it might not be, right? It's hard. This is why we're here. This is the class for tonight, right? Like, it's really examine, like, what would you guide them on and then go, how well did that fare for me, right? And if you have a lot of debt, why would you not want them to have a lot of debt, assuming it's good debt and assuming it helped you get wealthy, right? So did you want to follow up? James is, like, taking selfies.
These are newsletter photos.
So, part two, develop a wealthy mindset. How do we do that? Set realistic goals and write them down. This might be my single favorite bullet of the entire slide. How many of you have heard of the Yale Goal Study where they, like in 1953, took a survey of all the people who were graduating Yale? How many of you have like have written goals? How many of you are reviewing your goals? And it was like, then they re-examined them like 20 years later, and the top 3% who had written down goals and who were reviewing them regularly outperformed everyone else by 10x. How many of you heard of this study? Yeah, this study is entirely made up. It's in his book. I did research on it. It's Yale in 1953. It's Yale in 1954. It's also Harvard with the exact same stats. No one can actually produce a copy of this study. Not Yale, not Harvard. That doesn't mean this isn't true, right? I don't know that they would outperform them by 10x, but it's documented in lots of other studies that setting realistic goals and reviewing them regularly definitely helps your performance. However, this is not true. And 5 years ago, I taught it like it was true, so I'm correcting my mistake. Failure. Learn from it. Visualize your goal. They've done a ton of visualization in sports. So some of the like better sports teams, I guess some of the tennis players, I don't remember if this was at Stanford. This one's actually real. They took basically videos of them hitting the best shot they'd hit during matches, edited out all the other shots, had them watch it on a life-size screen, and basically they found that that would program almost the muscle memory so they could redo that shot in competition essentially at will. So some pretty interesting visualizing your goal and influencing your mind. Affirm yourself. James, is that good?
James, you're amazing.
See? That's exactly what I expected. This helps build confidence and self-esteem. He's got one in here. You guys can read the book, but it's like a 60-second affirmation that he would get up and say in the morning, right? It's like, Brian, you're amazing. You're going to change the world. You know, you're supportive, blah, 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 blah. And he said that to him every time, every day in the morning. I'm sure some of you have seen the YouTube video of the little girl standing on the counter saying the same thing to her in the mirror. How many of you have seen this? I'm awesome. I'm great. It's going to be a great day, right? I bet she has pretty good days. Replace luck with probability thinking. How many of you think that someone is lucky because they are wealthy? Like, oh, that guy, he's just lucky. Like, Brian, you're lucky because you just, James is raising his hand. James thinks I'm lucky.
I don't think you specifically are lucky, okay. But I definitely have seen people that are lucky.
Sure. But what would you attribute that luck to?
I think in a lot of cases, it's repeated attempts on goal and the willingness to accept failure. But in some cases, it truly is luck.
Like the lottery?
Well, if you're consistently playing the lottery, one could argue that that is, you know, persistent shots on goal. But, yeah, you can get lucky.
One could also argue that is bad debt.
Totally, I agree. You just happen to get lucky.
One could also argue you do not understand math.
True.
Right, so, you know, the better your attitude and the harder you work, the more luck you will generate, right? Like, I guarantee there are people that, like, know me that are like, oh, man, Brian's just lucky. Right, I probably have at least one close friend that probably thinks that. But underneath it, it's not luck. It's working your ass off again and 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 being willing to stay up and do the work. Right? It's not about just, oh, hey, I'm going to go buy a property this week. I wonder if I'll get lucky. Right? It's because every property that comes across, you look at. James has a snide comment here.
I was going to say, if people think you're lucky, you could show them your poker stats over time. And show them that you are statistically not lucky.
I am statistically unlucky, yes. Yes, that is very true. but if I live forever, I might come out.
You're going to have an upswing at some point.
Let's hope. So, yes. Develop a wealthy mindset, part two. Take action. Man, I think we have not harped on this enough this year, actually, as I thought about it. Like in 2017, when it was Brian will solve all your problems year, like, this was like every presentation. James or I would say, you've got to go take action. And so in the scheme of back to basics with the question earlier tonight, you have to go take action in order to make anything happen for yourself. Failure to act is obviously failure to succeed. If you fail to act once, learn from it, right? Go back to the failure bullet point. Go, failure's good. What did I learn? Next time you get a chance to act, don't fail again. Try and fail or fail to try. Which one's worse? Obviously, you should know. So, a quote from the book, when it came time to buy my first piece of real estate and I sat there with the seller in his home, petrified, my hands shaking, knowing nothing about the dangers and pitfalls of buying real estate and realizing that I would be risking everything I had, I remembered what my mentor had said. I would rather see a crooked furrow than a field unplowed, and I signed my name. I jumped off the cliff, so to speak, and that one decision, that one simple action started me on the road to wealth. I hate to think where I'd be if I had failed to act. For those of you who don't know, the very first property I bought, I was in tears trying to decide whether it was the right decision. I cry easy, so. 7 principles of wealth. Part 1. This is a short slide. Don't count your money until taxes and inflation are accounted for. Duh, right? I mean, this seems obvious, but if you're doing this, you're like, hey, I'm going to make $20,000 on this deal, and then you actually account for taxes and inflation, and you're like, I made $9,000, would you have still done it? Maybe, maybe not, right? Really try and factor that in. I guess I have to be closer. Make maximum use of your assets and sacrifice to invest things that go up in value. This, in essence, is delayed gratification. This is like half the story of my life, right? Delay gratification. I drive a 2007 Honda Accord. Delay gratification, right? There's one thing I've chosen to spend money on, and it happens to be the house I live in, but that's it. Everything else, delay, right? So, don't buy that big TV unless you can afford it. Right? What could you do instead of spending $2,000 on a TV? What could you take that $2,000 and invest it in where you'll make $10,000 and then buy your TV? Borrow money only to make money. This is a pretty key rule. This is very similar to earn more than you spend, right? Borrow money only if you are going to make money. This is good debt, versus bad debt. If you are borrowing money to buy a car, maybe you should think about that. But if you need the car to get to work, maybe you should make sure the car you buy is the cheapest car that's going to be reliable that you can actually utilize, right? And in full disclosure, I think there are times where, especially in the recent market, where if you're buying a car, there are 0% financing for 5 years. I think that is okay. I don't think it's great, but you know, 0 to a couple percent interest for 5 years instead of paying that cash up front and you can use that cash to go invest somewhere else, I don't think that's a bad choice. It might be for you. I recently had to do that, or chose to do that, because I was like, well, paying for a car, I might as well take a 1.9% rate and invest the money somewhere else and basically have the car get paid for.
I think this reminds me of the Kiyosaki story where he talks about taking money that you have and instead of buying a car for cash with it, you buy an asset that makes the monthly payment on your doodad. And then basically once the doodad is paid off, you still have the asset that is bringing in that monthly payment and you can use it for other things.
Totally agree. Also totally thirsty. These are like the smallest water cups ever. Forgot my water bottle. Don't diversify. So this one's highly debatable, right? Basically, concentrate all of your eggs in one basket, and then what should you do? Watch that basket really, really closely, right? This is an old quote from Dale Carnegie. Andrew Carnegie, not Dale. Andrew?
Andrew.
Andrew, yeah. That's not right. Wealth seekers are always on the offensive, not the defensive. I am definitely, for a long portion of my life, I was on the defensive, and I was the safe, secure, like, have a safe, secure job, like, utilize that income, try and save it, and then try not to lose money. If you play this way in poker, you will get destroyed, right?
Did you just say you were a safe, secure poker player? That was your safe, secure job?
No. But if you are not aggressive and on the offense, you will not do well building your wealth. I'm going to stand over here for a while, and then I'm going to hit this space bar. Money must multiply at wealth-producing rates of return, which we already covered. In order to do this, it's most likely you're going to have to use leverage. Choose investments that are both powerful and stable, right? Powerful grows at the rates of return that we would like them to grow at, and stable is grows steadily and relentlessly upward. So as an example, if you buy a house in that's a $30,000 or $40,000 rental property in Indianapolis, and 10 years ago it was worth $40,000, and 10 years from now it's going to be worth $40,000, but the cash flow looks great, does it qualify? No. Right? This is why we teach a class on this, right? Because it's not going up in value. There we go. Control is essential. Well placed. A fool and his money are soon parted, right? This is why I don't even know what class this is in, right? But how much control do you have of whether Amazon or Apple or Google or Microsoft stock goes up or down? Zippo, right? Even if you work there, how much control do you have of that? Right? It's like up on news, down on rumor, or up on rumor, down on news, whatever the saying is. So how much control do you have if you buy a single-family home and are renting it out?
Some.
Some to a lot, right? You get to pick the house. You can pick the best neighborhood, the worst neighborhood. That's your choice. You have control over that. You get to pick your tenant, right? You get to pick your terms, right? You get to basically control the entire investment. You don't like what's happening in the house, you can handle it yourself. You don't have to call the CEO of a company and be like, why is the stock price going down? I invested my money. I need it to go up, right? They're going to be like, who are you?
But to be fair, you don't control the HOA. You can't control tax increases.
But you can control to buy a property in or not in an HOA.
So what I was going to say was you don't control the HOA directly. You can influence it. You don't control tax increases in that local market, and you don't control that market. You can make good decisions, but you're not in control of all those pieces.
Sure. I don't think you're ever 100% in control, but there are things. You could buy a house that's not in an HOA neighborhood, eliminate that one. You can actually protest your taxes and not pay as much, right? Yeah, or you can elect officials. You at least get to vote. In a stock situation, you don't get shit, right? I mean, you don't. Like, you can vote, but you're like one vote out of 2 billion shares is like pointless, right? Yeah. So it's really a comparison of where do you have more control? And I don't know that you ever have full control, right? But I would much rather invest something where I know, hey, I can't control this stock or this mutual fund or the, you know, even when I had a financial planner who actually knew the managers of the funds, it still doesn't help, right? I get a little lower fees. They still can't control the fund, right? I'm still out of all control.
This is a tenet of Stoicism, the idea that there are only certain things that are within your control, and focus on the things that you can control and let go of the things that are outside of your control.
Yeah. Taxes, all outside of my control, mostly. So, do tell, Mr. Allen, how do we retire in 10 years? That's why we all came to class, right? All right, that's next week. Just kidding. Class is adjourned. We're early, James. Are you happy? So, here's Mr. Allen's retirement plan. Purchase 2 single-family homes per year. You get $10K per year to invest. Again, this book was written in 1983, I believe. So, this is the plan, and I'm going to update it, so don't worry. You get time to find and buy, below median price hopefully, and then manage them. His price was $150,000 in year one. 10% average annual appreciation.
Really?
Some years will be more, some years will be less, like a lot less.
So we've been in an extremely hot market. Does anyone remember seeing a year where we exceeded 10% appreciation in our market in a year?
Yeah, I think we were over 10 and 1.
I don't think that's true.
We hit 12 and 1 in one market, at least.
It depends on like what you were looking at,
yes.
But that is not universally true.
Yeah. So after 10 years, right, so we buy 2 properties year 1, 2 properties year 2, 2 properties year 3, all the way to year 10. After 10 years, sell the last 10 properties you bought, use the equity to basically pay off the first 10. That makes sense? So the first 10 you've been paying down for, well, the first 2 you've been paying down for 10 years. The next 2 you've been paying down for 9. So they have lower mortgage balances on them. They were cheaper houses. So hopefully the second 10 will be able to pay off that. Retire on the cash flow. He thought about $750 to $1,000 a month. And this was, again, in his day, which was basically that was the rental income and that's just profit, which... Maybe his cash flow is just gross cash flow, not net cash flow, but this is not how I personally think about it. So that was his plan, or get there and then repeat the process. You have 10, you sold 10 to pay him off, and now start over. Buy 2 more every year for the next 10 years and sell the second 10 to pay off the first 10. Seems like a reasonable plan, right? I mean, minus some higher numbers on appreciation and things like that. Does anyone think this plan might make sense?
I'm just worried that 10% average appreciation is the...
Yeah, aren't we all? Yes, it's a big nut. You're like, what?
Yeah.
So here's the actual numbers, blown out in a spreadsheet that none of you can read, so I will help you read it. Buy 2 houses in year 1, buy 2 more in year 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10, right? Average value of purchase that we started with was 150. It's going up 10% a year, so you can see this is at the end of year 1. Both houses are worth 165. You bought them at 150. You had about $2,200 of loan pay down. So your equity is 34,000. That's your total value of what the houses are worth, and that's what you owe. James is smiling.
That's an amazing looking spreadsheet. Where'd you get that thing from?
I think I built it. I think I built it, you built it, and then I used it. I don't know that you built it, though. I don't think so.
I remember teaching a full-day class on that spreadsheet.
Oh. Well, I have another one that I used, so.
It's got some math errors in it, so.
I fixed the math errors.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, because I was going through on later ones. I'm like, that doesn't make sense, and I fixed them. So,
thank
yeah.
You.
Yeah, it must have been you, because you named your variables, and I hate that.
Yep.
So Summary, equity of the first 10 after 10 years, $2.312 million. The debt on the second 10, $2.819. So the difference is $506,000, right? So you couldn't sell the first 10 and pay off the second 10, and obviously the difference is going to be the same here, but the equity of the second 10 is $1 million. The debt on the first 10 is $1.57 million. So his numbers don't actually pan out, right? You're not there yet, but you've got $3.4 million in equity at the end of 10 years. That's not bad. Let's dig in. What are the issues? All deals are nothing down, right? This is his deal, and in that time, probably it was okay, right? He's basically saying, hey, you've got $10,000 a year in 1983 to go find two properties you could buy with nothing down. $5K a year in 83, I don't know how much that is in today's dollars. What is that like? 30 years, 40 years ago, it's quite a bit of money. So, I don't know, 30 plus thousand each or something to go find one deal and get it for nothing down in a market that's vastly different than the one we're in today. Obviously, that's pretty difficult in some markets. It assumes 10K to spend per year. The 100K payback of that 10K is not included. So really, you're not down 506,000, you're down 606. Average annual appreciation. You guys all laughed. You already know this is an issue. Purchase price of 150, clearly not representative of our market today, or no one would be here. We'd all be buying houses right now.
Yeah.
Right? Hey, there's a sale. There's 40 houses for 150K. I'd be like, it's okay. They're all under contract. obviously, those are not typically ideal houses in our marketplace. And this quote is from 5 years ago when our average price was 225. Right, which isn't that far off from 150. So if you were here, James is going to say it is that far off.
No, I was going to say, I think at the time, there were some like pretty rough houses in Greeley that we could find for 150.
Yes,
they were
150,
just,
160, 170 yeah. For sure. Absolutely. So that's another issue. We talked about that one already. You're already 506 off. You basically only need another year to make it work, though. So it's pretty close. Your equity is now building at such a rate that if you just wait another year at 10% appreciation, right, you will have another $500,000. With 5% appreciation, so if we drop it to something that is at least somewhat reasonable, we're short $1 million after 10 years. This thing is dead. It still takes us another 5 years at that point to make the plan work at 5% appreciation. However, let's stop and think about that. You invest some time and $10,000 a year, and you go buy 20 properties, and 15 years later, you've got 10 free and clear properties. That's not a bad 15 years. Sounds a whole lot similar to some other plan that we teach here. What's that plan called?
Yeah, it's called Nomad.
Oh, Nomad, so, that's right.
So here's an interesting point about the cash flow portion of it, is that typically the rule of thumb is two-thirds
of rent.
Yeah, two-thirds of the gross rent is what you would be able to keep if you had the properties paid off. And so these properties would be paid off, and if you use a 1% rent rule, so $150,000 property.
His rent was $1,200.
Yeah, so it's probably a little
bit less. So $800, right?
Yeah, so $8,000 or so for the per month.
Yeah, $8,000 a month, right?
Yeah.
That's not bad for, you know, doing some work, not necessarily full-time, for 15 years. So how do we adjust this, right? Making it work for Northern Colorado, maybe. Purchase price, $350. Interest rate, 5%. Appreciation, 5%. Still using nothing down deals to start. Oh, question.
Sorry, I just had a question. Did he take into consideration the new roofs that are going to be needed and the refrigerators that break and all that stuff?
I mean, so normally that's taken into account from rental expenses, right? So he doesn't cover that in detail, but if we were covering that in a class like Nomad, hopefully your cash flow and your savings is accounting for things that go wrong, right? You do need reserves, right, which are not accounted for here. So, I mean, this is a plan he made up in 1983, and this is the problem when you talk to other investors about, hey, what do you actually make on your rentals? Because hey, I have this property, and it rents for $1,500, and the mortgage is $500, so I make $1,000 a month. Well, you don't. because you might have a property manager, you're spending your own time, you've got maintenance stuff, but that's how some people think, right? And so you really have to make sure you're comparing apples to apples. But I'm literally trying to like analyze what he says in the book. And in my experience, what I try to do with my properties is that cash flow takes care of all of that stuff. Obviously, if you need a new roof, the spreadsheet actually has this, and I'll show it next week, right? You plug in what you think a new roof is going to cost, how long your roof is going to last, and you should be saving that much money each month as well. So, do you have a question? Somebody? I thought I saw a hand. No? Sorry. False alarm. So you get $10K per year to spend. Meh. It's a little less than probably what he would have given you. So what does it look like in our market? See, I don't think you built this part.
It's possible you added on to mine, but I definitely remember building.
So, year one, same thing, right? Purchase price, $350,000. Again, we're buying them for nothing down. Could you, if you had to, and your life depended on it, go out with $10,000 and find one deal in a year's time in our market to buy for nothing down? Do you think you could accomplish that?
I know I could.
Could you do two?
I know I could.
With $10,000?
Yes.
So, James has just offered that if you pay him $10,000 plus two commissions, he will find you two nothing down houses.
That is not true.
No? I thought if I added the two commissions in there, it was like a done deal.
The challenge is that you'd be converting manual labor into finding deals. You'd be doing very...
No doubt.
Manual labor intensive stuff.
Yep. But from an experienced real estate investor, you could go out and find at least one deal, probably two in a year for $10K. You would have to do a lot of work, especially in the current market conditions. There are other market conditions where it wouldn't take you $10K and you could do a lot less work to find them. So, what do we find out? 10 years down. 10 years down is right here. $3.36 million in equity. Not bad. Equity of the first 10, $2.3 million. Debt on the second 10, $4.7 million. Basically, we're $2.3 million off from paying them off, right? 15 years out, however, we can pay them off. So again, are you willing to go find two deals a year, spend $10K of money, and 15 years later have $7.5 million in equity and 10 free and clear houses with, in today's market, these are probably roughly $2,000 a month rentals, rounding, right? So you're talking about, you know, $700-ish dollars a month, sorry, $1,400 a month for cash flow times 10. That doesn't look too bad, $14K a month. It's livable, for sure. Any questions on this? Yes, microphone.
I'm kind of hung up on selling the last 10 you buy.
Okay.
Because you're paying commissions on that, right? And if you just bought them at a fair market value and you're turning around and selling them in a short-term time, then it's probably going to be an upside-down situation once you pay the closing costs.
So let's take a look. The last house we actually buy is in year 10. So obviously, if you bought two houses at the beginning of the year and turned around and sold them, you're probably not going to be making any money. However, waiting five more years at 5% appreciation, that goes away really fast, right? Call it 6 or 7% for commission and sale costs, right? 1.3 years of appreciation basically annihilates that, right? So then you've got, that's part of the reason it takes 15 years, right? The other thing is you're paying these down and they're cheaper. You bought them earlier, which you'd rather pay those off. You could definitely switch and pay the second ones off if you wanted, but these are worth more, right? The loans on them are less, your cash flow is higher, and then when you pay them off, they're free and clear, and your cash flow is even better. So it does seem weird in the book that he would buy two each year and then sell the ones he just bought in year 10. But, I mean, it also seems weird that he's using 10% appreciation. So,
Why couldn't you calculate where your highest...
Go ahead.
Where you're making the most money and choose those houses.
You absolutely would, right? I mean, you could look at these and you could go, you know what, this house I bought, the neighborhood's like not doing as well. I'm going to totally sell that one, and I'm going to use the money to pay off the one I bought over here. That would be the smart decision. We teach a class on portfolio optimization that kind of covers that, where you are going to pick the ones that, hey, which one has a lot of CapEx coming up? Maybe I don't want to deal with that CapEx. Maybe I'd like to sell all 20 and buy 10 new houses so I don't have any CapEx for at least 5-10 years, right? There's infinite possibilities with doing this. And so this is why it's hard to teach the class, because I'm reviewing his book and then I'm trying to create his same model for our market, and I'm definitely not hitting all the things that we would normally hit, right? You'll notice that one of the bullet points earlier in the slide deck was, don't count your money until inflation and taxes have been paid. I'm not paying any taxes here, right? So you start including that, it takes even longer. You start including commissions and sale costs, it takes even longer. To combat that, right, you could easily sell these on lease option, right? Or you could sell them and just take a note, right? And then you've still got passive income, but you don't own the house, right? That doesn't help you pay off the first 10 if you just take a note or lease option them, but there are other ways around paying the commission, as much as James probably doesn't like that. So that is the 350K plan at 5% and 5%. These are obviously likely to fluctuate, right? If you write this plan down and go execute it and 15 years come back and you're like, it's not working, Brian, it's not my fault. These are rough numbers, right? Your interest rate, both for appreciation and for mortgage, are going to fluctuate. Interest rates might be 7% in a couple years, and not too long ago they were at 3-point-something. So, $2.33 million, right? We already talked about this. It takes an extra 5 years to actually pay that off, the difference between the 10. But you still created $3.4 million of equity in 10 years. Try and do that in your W-2 job. I think that's the bigger point, right? Whether this number is 3.4 or 2.1, 10 years from now, are you going to have $2.1 million from your W-2 job? If you are, keep working, right? Although some would argue, and I argued to myself, that it wasn't worth it. I could do better elsewhere, right? Or 5 years later, you've got $7.5 million in equity. Like 15 years from now, can you generate that? And what do you see here, right? You see, oh my gosh, 45K in equity, 140K in equity, 300K in equity, 500K in equity. What year is this? This is 4. So 4 years in, I'm going to read you from the book. It's totally grammatically correct. And this is just kind of his plan, but there's a part in here that I definitely want you guys to hear. So suppose you bought one house per year for 10 years. Your first house costs $150K. Every house thereafter costs 10% more. This investment program would have the growth trajectory outlined on this page. See that nice graph? It's not necessary to see it. The first few minutes of a NASA space launch are the most critical. During these few minutes, the mighty booster rockets groan and strain to lift the space vehicle beyond the Earth's enormous gravitational pull. Then the boosters are no longer needed and are jettisoned. The ship falls into a natural orbit, and the breath of a baby is all that is needed to propel it. I didn't actually remember that that was in there. That's pretty good. You can all go dream about that. So, as it is with the struggling years of stage two, this is this right here. This is the point. We groan and strain under the enormous influence of or gravity of our anti-wealth programming. All the stuff we've been taught, like, hey, I went and did this silly shit that Brian just said, and I'm only here after 4 years. Like, there's no way I'm getting to here. Like, it's not happening, right? Instead of the usual instant gratification, these first years are years of sacrifice. Delay your gratification, in which the results don't seem to justify the effort. According to the chart, after 3 years of sacrifices, your net worth is about 100K in the book, and it's just over 400,000 in 5 years. To say this another way, after having used up half the time allotted to reach your goal, you're less than halfway there, right? 5 years in, you're at 776. You're very far away from where you want to be. That can be discouraging. The gravitational pull of the world is very strong here. The get-rich-quick myth starts to wither and die about the third year when you realize that becoming financially independent is not fun anymore, right? It's not. You're delaying gratification. Right? You don't get all the fun stuff you want. You have to do work, and it's hard. This is where we lose most of the crowd. Mission aborted. The price demanded has exceeded the ability to pay. Many drop out, content to tell stories about the big one that got away. These first few years are also fraught with the temptation to find a quicker, easier route. The impatient are quick to abandon ship for the first fool's gold investment opportunity that comes along. For every solid booster rocket investment, there are 10,000 imitations being bandied about. Now is not the time to change horses in midstream. It is the time for persistence. As the chart shows, it is only in the fifth year and beyond that your wealth starts to gain momentum. The reason why is that you made the commitment to concentrate almost all of your investment energies into one and only one investment vehicle. You put almost all of your eggs into the right basket. Now don't forget to watch over it. That is the key. If you quit here, you're right here. You're like, I did everything I was supposed to. The diamond is literally a few feet away, and you quit. And this happens all the time. People will show up to class. They will go buy a property. And then something will go wrong, and they will abandon all hope. Right? Don't let that happen to you. That is the, this is the hockey stick of investments. Right? Your wealth is going to do this. If you quit anywhere from here to like here, you never see this skyrocket effect. You have to wait it out and be persistent. So, let that last slide sink in. Spend $142K over 10 years. $10K per year, assuming 5% inflation. I don't think that's supposed to be 5%. Maybe it is supposed to be 5% inflation. That's some high inflation, at least for now.
That's what the appreciation was.
Yes, that's what I meant to type. But even if you assume it takes $20K per year, it's still amazing, right? Even if this number is doubled, you had $7.5 million in equity after 15 years by spending a fraction of that to get there across a time period of 10 years. In year 15, pay off the first properties. Cash flow is about $1,200 per month per properties. It's about $144K per year. Does that seem pretty good? Yeah. Seems good to me. Plus, you have $7.5 million in equity in cash. Yay. Like, really, yay. Like, that's amazing. So, $142K plus some work, maybe a lot of work, plus some time, maybe a lot of time, equals this. That's pretty awesome. I like it. Most people vastly underestimate their retirement needs. There was a point in time where I was young and naive, and I was like, yeah, if I had $1 million, I could totally retire. And then it was like, oh, if I had $2.5 million, I could totally retire. I'm like, this is at, you know, 30 or something. And you're like, you very quickly learn as you get old and almost, or 50 or whatever I am, right, that's just, like, it depends on what kind of lifestyle you want to have. But if you're 30 and you think you can survive on $2.5 million for 70 years, woo, good luck, right? I mean, that's rough. You know, if you're 90, I think you got it, right? Cash flow keeps pace with inflation. I clearly should have had this disappear because it's driving me crazy now. If you can live on it today, you should also be able to live on it tomorrow. However, there's a lot of stuff there that is going to change. Your tax bracket could change. Many people expect their tax bracket to go down as they get older. Your tax bracket might go up. Right? Your health may be good, your health may be bad, insurance may be good, insurance may be bad. There's all sorts of things that may put some volatility into that. So, NCREG plan versus typical retirement. Normally a financial planner, right, comes and says, hey, here's our savings plan. Save a giant pile of money and then live off of it. Right? How many of you have heard this? Right? Oh, you just save a big pile of money and then pull out 3 or 4% a year and live off that. James taught a class on this and the safe withdrawal rate. I don't even know what class that was in.
Neither do I.
The safe withdrawal rate class that's not up there on the podcast. But how long are you going to live? This comes back to that thing we talked about in the beginning. If you don't know how long you're going to live and you don't know what your spending is going to be, because you're guessing. When you're 35 and the planner is like, how long are you going to live and what are you going to spend when you're retired? And what year are you going to retire? Come on. Like, I'm going to spend $10K a month when I'm retire at 55, and I'm going to live till I'm 97. Like, if I say that, my numbers show one thing. If I'm like, I'm going to retire at 50, I'm going to spend $12K a month, and I'm going to live till I'm 105, the numbers are vastly different. Like, you better guess really well. Or just, I mean, you have to be like, I'm going to live till I'm 112, and I'm going to spend $50K a month, and overshoot, and then you'll be okay. So, what if I work longer than I need to? What if I don't work long enough? Will the day you retire be relaxing or stressful? It comes back to that. I think you all should shoot for making it be relaxing. So, if you wanted to achieve 144K from the stock market, right, save up a big pile of money and achieve that in cash flow, how much money do you need to start with?
$4.4 million.
$2.87 million at the 5.016 S&P average for the last 40 years. So if you started today and you assume the S&P is going to perform exactly the same, you'd need $2.87 million to throw off 144 a year.
So you're assuming you have a 5% safe withdrawal rate?
I'm assuming that you basically have this much money, it's generating 5%, which is that, and you're pulling that 144, you're never touching your principal.
Yeah, so what happens there is you actually don't keep pace with inflation, you end up removing more money. So that's why you have to use a safe withdrawal rate number.
Yeah. So this plan also doesn't account for that $7.5 million that you had in equity after 15 years. That doesn't exist in this plan. So to James's point, you need to save more than 2.87, and you don't have this other 7.5 just to get the cash flow that you would get from doing this for 15 years. So even if you throw taxes and commissions into this picture, it's not going to exhaust this $7.5 million of equity. That equates to saving $191,000 in today's dollars every year for 15 years. Good luck. Play the lottery, I guess, is the...
And that still wouldn't get you to the equity position. It would only get you to the stock market position.
Yes. Thank you for reading my next bullet. Variations to the plan. All right. Let's talk about how else we can do this. You could put 20% down on each property, right? Down payment required, $1.4 million in today's dollars. So what's amazing to me is 5 years ago when I taught this class, that number was 900K. 5 years. How many of you wish you would have started this 5 years ago? Yeah. You just literally gained yourself $500,000 if you started 5 years ago. It's that simple. How much longer are you going to wait?
5 years.
Well, I have a feeling it's going to be 2+ million at that point. So this is a serious question. Like, really consider this. When I went back and looked, because normally we teach classes more often than once every 5 years, right? And this one just fell through the cracks, and we didn't have a recording, so we're like, let's go back and record it. But $500,000, like $500,000, 5 years, if you just would have started this plan, you could have saved yourself $500,000. It's pretty amazing. Even if this was the only option, right, and you had to come up with $1.4 million, it's still much less than saving that $2.87 million that you need to throw off $144K a year, even without James's safe withdrawal rate. And it still doesn't account for the equity. If you do this, it takes almost 12 years to pay off 10 houses by selling the last 10. So I have the spreadsheet if anybody wants to see it. If James wants to actually post the spreadsheet, I have all of them in there from tonight. You're more than welcome to. move each year. Hey, this sounds familiar. 5% down, and then on your second property each year, 20% down. So this is essentially Nomad with buying an extra rental property each year.
Was that in the previous class from 2014?
Yeah.
It was?
Yeah. I started thinking, oh.
That's crazy, actually.
What year was Nomad actually invented?
It was after that.
Yeah. Royce is out.
Yeah, that's interesting. Right, it was named.
True.
Like, we didn't invent
it. Yes, it was invented long before. So, down payment and this required, $175K plus $700K, $875K in today's dollars. Takes over 13 years, just over 13 years, to pay off 10 houses by selling 10. That's not bad either, right? It's getting a little longer. But still, it's less than 15. Or move each year and find your second property as a nothing down deal. So you're nomading and you're spending that extra money to go find a nothing down deal. You need $175K plus $10K per year to find your second deal, which is what we allotted from the beginning as well. And this is what it looks like. 5% down and nothing down deal each for 10 years. So this is the 20% down. Oh, sorry, this is 5% down. This is nothing down. We start at $350,000. The 5% down price is $332,500. We're just using 5% for interest rate, 5% for appreciation rate. And you can see, right, it's that same thing. You got to wait to really have your equity build and your wealth build. Here's your 10. You're still $2.1 million short. You can't pay them off yet. But year 15, you can pay them off. You've got $7.6 million in equity, and you've got another $355 in cash. Obviously, minus commissions and tax and all that. But $7.6 million, still a nice number, 15 years, right? This is you nomading for 10 years in a row, normal nomad plan, and finding one extra deal, nothing down every year. Any questions on that? Sweet. Nothing? So, like I said before, right? Most are going to quit this after 4 years, $573K in equity, right? You're like, oh man, this sucks. I've been doing all this work. How am I ever going to get to millions? But then you just hang on, continue, be persistent, and you will get there. Stay the course. So, same plan. I'm like, I still don't like 5% appreciation. Still seems awfully high to me. And I'm like, what if the interest rate was a little higher? Right? Let's not look at, hey, really good scenario. Let's look at, well, appreciation at 3.5 is normal. Interest rate at 6 is a little higher than what it is now. What does it actually look like? It's not too bad. Right? It obviously takes a little longer. Appreciation rate is much slower than 10% for sure, but even than 5%. But still, in year 10, you've got $2.5 million in equity. You're still $2.5 million from being able to pay them all off by selling 10. After 15 years, you're substantially closer, right? $755,000 is this difference down here. And if you notice, we went from $4.5 million to 5.1. So in about one more year, you'll be able to pay all of the second 10 off, the first 10 off with the second 10 by selling them. So it's about a 16-year plan in this particular case with really conservative appreciation and what I might consider slightly aggressive interest rate. So it's not like it's suddenly 25 years, right? You still just have to be persistent. Any questions on that? Does that surprise any of you? Because it surprised me when I ran it. I was like, I thought it'd be a little worse. But 16 years instead of 15? Nah, that's not bad. Yep. So, a slower acquisition plan. I didn't even remember this slide was in here. Thought I was done. Slower acquisition, 5% down in the first year, and then you give yourself an entire year to find one no down. And then the next year, you nomad, 5% down. The next year, no down. And then, not till we get to year 5, do you do both. I just slowed it down a little, right? So where do we end up? Almost kind of in the same place, right? We have 700,000 here, but we built about $715,000 in equity between the end of year 14 and the end of year 15. So in one more year, this plan is done as well. You started slower. Still takes 16 years. You still got to do the work to find the no down, but it's not that much different than if you just bought two every year, right? You're like, hey, I've got enough for 5% down now. Great, guess what? You have 2 years and $10,000 to go find one nothing down property. Could you find one in 2 years? I had a question.
What appreciation and interest rate assumptions did you make?
Is this running with the 3.5% appreciation or
this
the
5%? This is 5 and 5.
Okay, it's 5 and 5.
Yep.
Was this in the original slide deck?
Yes.
It's crazy.
I know, right? So how do you make this plan work for you? Maybe you don't, but you can always just, you know, use Nomad. Initially, go budget. Have a budget. Save, right? This alone requires discipline and sacrifice. Get used to that. Get used to delaying gratification and save so that you can invest. Acquire as fast as you can within that budget. If it takes you 2 years to get your first property, so be it. What can you sacrifice today to make that a year and a half? Ask yourself that question, right? This is how you build wealth. Focus on nothing down deals until the budget allows 5% down, right? Nothing down deals are hard in this market, period. You can find them if you want to. You can find owner finance or subject to wrap deals. They're really difficult to find right now. Doesn't mean it's not doable. You could use sandwich lease options to boost your savings. You could consider borrowing against current assets. Do you already own a home that has equity in it? Can you pull the equity out of that and go buy a rental property? Many of the above, like I said, are difficult in our market. They were a little bit easier 5 years ago. Not for long, though. right? But eventually, our market's going to change. And like, I don't know, was it last summer, 2 summers ago when James taught all of the how to buy properties off market, right? It's useful knowledge. It's not as applicable right now. But when the market changes, if you're prepared, guess what? You're going to be way ahead of the curve.
Yeah, we taught it so that you'd have the information. That way, when the market does change, you're not waiting for us to teach those classes. It's
right.
Already done.
Yeah. And you're already practicing, hopefully. Or simply ignore this entire presentation and use the Nomad model, which was apparently created in 2014.
Apparently it was.
And then use Real Estate Financial Planner to do all these calculations a whole lot better than I did for you tonight. In summary, this will be the first class I've ever finished more than 15 minutes early. That's the entire summary. Find a way to apply the following, right? Challenge the false assumptions of building wealth, right? All that stuff we talked about at the beginning, go and think about, hey, what's ingrained? Challenge everything that you're thinking about building wealth. Develop a wealthy mindset. Understand the principles of wealth. Go read this book, although skip the chapter on like buying stamps. It's not worth a reading.
And coins.
And yeah, there's like a whole chapter on buying stamps and coins. Just skip it. Trust me. You can make this plan or a variant work for you, right? Budget and planning, hard work and sacrifice. Go do this. It's hard, but take action. If you don't take action, it's never going to happen, right? That's not even trying. You're not failing. You're failing to try. Don't let that be you. Ask for help. We're here every week, 6 to 8, sometimes 6 to 9 if I'm teaching. Just depends. But James will be like, 6 to 9, that's generous. More like 6 to 9:30. But there's plenty of resources. You can come and ask, and there is help. But you got to do the work for yourself first, right? Always run your own numbers, because the gurus might be wrong, right? This might be wrong. The Nomad model calculations might be off.
James's spreadsheet might be wrong.
James's spreadsheet might be wrong, although it's corrected for tonight. So run your own numbers. And then the quote from the book, right, that really applies. Don't wait to buy real estate. Buy real estate and wait. You've heard me say that before, but it applies. If you'd have bought even 3 or 4 houses in 2014 and you'd have just waited 5 years, you'd have had about 100K in equity for each house you bought. You had 10 houses, you just had $1 million in equity in 5 years. That's insane. So, one last slide. Too good to be true. But Mr. Allen, all of what you say sounds interesting, even feasible, but it goes against everything my parents have always taught me. How are your parents doing financially? He asks. Terribly. They're really strapped for money. And that is all I have. Let that one sink in. Questions, comments, thoughts, concerns, complaints?
How many people came to the fire class I taught where we
fire!
Did
yeah,
exactly. So do you remember the conversation during that class where Brian and Royce kept harassing me about what about the equity you have in your properties? You could actually take the equity and use that to pay off other properties or pull out, do cash out refinance and use it in the stock market in order to retire early. Do you ever remember this part? So this class is basically that discussion, right? The idea that you buy more properties than you need, you use the equity in those properties to then sell off some and pay off the remaining ones. You guys get that? So I've since redid the Real Estate Financial Planner to be able to add that rule. And the punchline for those of you that came to that class or that are going to watch the recording is I think when you do the model where you buy more than you need, actually, you don't even buy more than you need. You buy 11 properties total, one that you live in, 10 Nomad properties. If you wait to the point where you have enough equity in some of them to pay the rest off, and by the way, it's not 5. It's not like you sell 5. It turns out you sell like 6 or 7.
I think it was 6 and 4.
Yeah,
right?
six or seven, whatever it was. And you end up selling off 6 properties or so, and then you pay off the remaining 4, and that gives you enough money to hit your retirement number. That only takes 13 years. So it ends up being the fastest way to strategize for that. And it is included in the book. So if you guys are interested in reading about that strategy, it's in the book. It's available on Amazon. So any other questions about that? Yeah.
I have a question. So you've
gone through the book and his strategy in the book. Would you have been better off by holding all 20 properties?
Yes.
Sure.
Okay.
I mean, if you can hold them out and pay them off, you're going to have way more.
Well, they're paying themselves off.
Yes. You're going to have way more cash flow. But they don't have.
But you won't retire earlier.
Yeah.
Ah. Okay.
Yeah, you're not going to hit, if you've got, those first two aren't going to pay off fully, right? Your mortgage payment's not done for 30 years, so you're at a 30-year okay. window. So if you'd rather buy three houses every year and then sell, you know, 15 after 15 years and have 15 free and clear, you could do that if you needed more cash flow.
So you get more cash flow in the long run, but not as soon as if you sold 10 to
right.
pay off the other 10.
Yes. And so you could model it where you wait and say, hey, in order for my cash flow number, I need to not have 10 properties. I need to have 14. And you could wait until the point where you sell 6 and pay off 14. But you're going to be waiting a lot longer.
Yeah. One of the big ahas from the FIRE class, the Financial Independence Retire Early class, was, yeah, exactly, was that you a lot of times you trade speed of retirement for standard of living in retirement, and rarely do you get both. Yeah. So you can actually accumulate more assets, retire later, but your standard of living when you do retire is much higher, or you can retire earlier and have a lower standard of living when you do that. And there is a hybrid model, which we didn't teach, which I'll have to write another book about.
Yeah, and I want to make a comment, too. Like, this is buy 20 houses, sell 10 to pay off 10. There's nothing wrong with buying 6 houses and selling 3 to pay off the other 3.
Yeah, especially right? if you only need
right.
$4,000 for your retirement income.
Yeah, and this is in the book, right? But it's like, if you don't need $144,000 or $12,000 a month, right, and you only want $5,000 a month, great. Figure out what that plan is. And this is the encouragement. If any of you ask me questions after class, or if you're filling out this application for the mastermind thing, like, one of my first questions, and it's on there, is like, what's your current plan? And how are you getting to it? Because if you don't have that, answering the rest of this is pointless. So without the plan, it's really hard. If you know, hey, my lifestyle is X, it's going to cost Y, how do I get to Y from where I'm at? It's a very easy starting place. And then you could have a decent conversation about it. But without that, it's really tough.
And I've heard from people over the years, we've been doing this since 2003, I've been hearing from people over the years that it's hard for me to visualize the plan. It's hard for me to sit down and do the details and understand all that, which is one of the reasons why the level of detail we do with Nomad, a plan that is completely done for you, is excruciatingly in detail. I mean, we go into like the craziest level of detail for you so that you don't have to figure it out. You just plug into the Nomad model and it works.
Yep.
Any other questions? Yeah, James, 1 second, I'll get the mic.
On one of your later slides in that, you take into account like slowing down and is stretching out the process a little bit if you want. But and I know a lot of your calculations and stuff are hidden, but does it take into account, say, like rent increase and you're using that extra increase over 5 or 10 years to start paying down faster? I mean, is there ways to speed this up if you were
sure.
super diligent?
Yeah, I mean, you can speed this up in a lot of ways. I mean, you could go and do Lisa. I mean, long ago we taught a class, and I mean, even James's class last week was about, you know, you can use the Nomad model and you could sell these off using a lease option and boost the process. The reason I don't even mess with rent here, like in the beginning I didn't even mess with loan pay down, but I added that into the later years because it's already in the top years, is just that rent is paying your mortgage, right? So as rent increases, hopefully it's keeping pace with what your mortgage costs and your maintenance costs are. And that's just kind of like, it's a wash, right? It's some magic hand waving where it's close enough that it's not going to adjust $7.5 million to zero, but it might adjust it to $6.8 million across the course of 15 years, okay. right?
So my question was, the whole model that Robert
Allen
based this on was zero, nothing down, and James kept alluding to, I could do that. I would just like to hear one example.
One example where you could buy a house nothing down? Yes. Buy subject to.
I think everybody's ears went up.
Buy subject to.
Yeah,
so you
I think,
buy the property subject to the existing financing.
Sure. And I think James has sent more marketing than I'm sure the combination of everyone in this room have ever sent, right, by like 10x. So, like, when he says he can do it, I totally believe he could do it. Do I think I could do it? Yes. It would probably be slower than what he would do, but I feel like I could get it done based on my knowledge set. Is it easy for someone who's never bought a house, talked to a seller, done a contract, right, or any of that, to go out and do that? No, it is hard as hell, right? And that's why, like, if you ask me, one of you guys said you want to do wholesaling. Yeah, so don't talk to me after class. James will tell you I'll crush your dream. That's what he says, right? Because in the same vein, wholesaling is really hard, especially in our current market, right? That doesn't mean you can't do it. It doesn't mean you can't go be successful at it. It just means there are easier paths to probably get where you need to be or want to be than doing that. And so in this case, this is really hard. I would not set out to go do 20 nothing down deals across 10 years. I would probably like try and do Nomad or 20% down. And then when the market turned and it was like nothing down deals and subject to deals were there, I would be scooping them, right? And it would be like, hey, Brian did a 5% down, then he did a 20% down, and then the market turned and he did 6 subject twos in the same year, right? Like, I would wait for that to happen because I think at some point it will happen, but I don't know when. It could be 2 years, it could be 5 years, it could be 10 years. We don't know, but it's hard, right? And that's that. I think that is the how hard is anyone willing to work to make this happen? And that is like beyond key for everything. If you're not willing to put in the time, you're just not going to make it.
Yeah, so. Those that really do want to learn about the subject to and the marketing and structuring deals and everything else, there was a summer. It wasn't last summer.
I think it was 2017.
It was either 2017 or 2016, but there's like 10 classes in a row that go into crazy detail about how to do that whole business model.
Yeah.
So go watch that because we're probably not teaching that class again for a very long time.
Yeah. And since I mentioned the wholesale thing and since I got 8 minutes left to burn so I can just be on time, right? The thing with wholesaling is imagine like if you go out and you're wholesaling and you're like going out and talking to sellers, A, you've got to be really good at talking to sellers, right? In order to be really good at talking to sellers, you've got to be able to find their problem and then find a way to solve their problem. Okay, that's a learnable skill. Practice and you'll get better, right? However, if you've never done a lease option, you've never done a subject to or a wrap deal, you've never just bought a rental or managed a tenant or any of the things that might be in place with that particular seller, it's very hard to negotiate a deal that you're then going to give to an experienced investor who's going to be like, yeah, this is a great deal, right? So it's hard to, you're basically wholesaling is like, I need to know everything about all the different deal types and contracts and my investors and what they want, and then I'm going to make the perfect execution. And it's not to say it can't be done, right? It's just to say there's a lot of learning to get from point A to point B where we've proven in class that if you just buy one long-term buy and hold and hold it, it's basically the same as doing one flip per year for every year you hold it, right? And it's vastly superior to doing one wholesale deal a year. So what's easier? Is it easier for you to go find a nothing down deal and buy it yourself and hold as a rental? Or is it easier to do Nomad? Or is it easier to go learn this entire giant set of skills and then struggle for a while, probably? And then if it takes off, it takes off. There was a story about, I think it was Chicago. Somebody was like, I'm going to go be the best wholesaler in Chicago. And they were like, dude, there's already like 10 really amazing wholesalers that are huge and they're experts, you have no chance. And he was like, nope, that's what I'm going to do. And he crushed it, right? He went and he did it and said, nope, I'm going to be the best, and he made it. So it's not to say that it's not possible. It's just that's my pitch on crushing people's dreams, like James likes to say.
Yeah, so you've just accelerated that process. Instead of having to do one-on-one conversations,
yeah.
We just recorded it. Everyone could listen to it, and they can hear the same
thing. You should shop that off as like
an
excerpt.
Yeah.
Like, want a wholesale? Here's your dream crushed.
Yeah, and I would recommend for those that want a wholesale, I would encourage you to do Nomad in parallel.
Yeah.
Because at least you'll be on the Nomad path and be acquiring rental properties while you figure out the wholesaling stuff. And you can
as opposed to waiting 2 years.
As opposed
right?
to waiting and then finding
or
out.
Or 5 years and finding out you could have had $500K.
And the other thing I'll add is, and I did a class on wholesaling very recently, which I'll give you a quick summary. It is, as a wholesaler, you're doing both parts of the job of buying and selling. So you got to go find the buyer, and you got to go find the seller, and you got to actually go do both sides of that transaction, usually for less of a fee than a typical real estate agent would make doing one side. And you have to find a deal. You have to find something that is investor grade. So if you were going to be a wholesaler, you might be better off getting your real estate license and representing one side of the transaction. You could make more money and do less work by only representing half the side, and you could do retail. You don't have to do a investor grade.
And in fairness, that's still a business you have to run and put money into.
No
and you have
doubt.
To go build up your clientele, and
yep.
you still have to be an expert in your field.
Yep.
Like, that's also not easy.
I agree with that.
I mean, there are plenty of realtors who are realtors in quotes, and they sell one house a year to
yeah.
a friend.
Yeah,
right?
like the average income for a realtor is really, really low.
Yeah. So it all comes back to taking action,
yeah.
right? Take action, build your wealth, be successful, tell us how you retired early, And that's that. Any questions?
Oh, one other thing about James's comment. So James was asking, can you take the money and use the rent, you know, the extra money you're getting, and apply it to paying down stuff? Yes, that's what the real estate financial planner does, all correctly. And it takes into account all that stuff. Like his,
I just didn't do it.
Not just Brian, but the creating wealth thing. It's
oh yeah.
The math is
it's fishy,
suspicious at times.
Yeah.
You know, I really appreciate the stuff he did, but at the same time, there's a couple things. Who is the question?
Right here.
Well, I get it. It just opened up a few things. That it'd be cool to see one of these, you know, your spreadsheets. What if after say year four, you didn't sell, and you refinanced, did cash out, and you bought four more houses? And then a couple years later, you could accelerate this to such a point.
Yeah, so refinancing and buying four more houses after 4 years, you're probably not going to have enough equity. Let me back up to a different.
While he looks up the stuff on his spreadsheet, I will tell you, the real estate financial planner allows you to do that modeling. So you could say, buy four properties, and then whenever you have enough doing cash out refinances to buy another property, go ahead and buy another one. So it allows you to do that too.
Yeah, so just as a note, right, this is year one, year two, year three, and year four. So this is these are the houses you buy in year four, right? Even the first ones you bought 4 years later, like this has almost $100,000 in equity. You're only going to be able to borrow up to 75%. So you're talking about 75K coming out of this one, and we'll just wave and say that's 80K.
It's not, though, because it's the value of the property. Yeah. So you're only going to be able to borrow, like, up to 300.
True. Yes, so you can't even borrow yet.
Yeah, I mean,
this was nothing down. That's the problem.
Yeah, basically you're at a 400,000-ish type property,
yep.
And that's what the value is. So 75% is 300, so you're still negative.
Yeah.
You can't even borrow.
Pull money out here.
Yeah, depending how much you put down.
Yeah, so if we go back to the 20% slide. Maybe. Yeah. I just talked about it.
I think you just talked about it. You didn't actually put a
correct. Yep, I just talked. I have the 20% one. I can pull it up. Did you copy it over?
It probably is down there, but yeah. I prefer you don't go to the desktop.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you could look, and even with 20% down, you're not going to be able to pull money out and buy four houses, right? You probably will be able to maybe buy one more off that one house.
Yeah.
And so you could do it that way.
Portfolio loan or something.
Sure, but even then, you're still buying one to two houses because you just bought, you know, that's the ones you bought in year one. Not the ones you bought in year two. They're a year behind that, and a year behind that, and a year behind that. So at some point, you could choose to do that instead, right? You could choose to, like, try and pile all your debt on a couple houses and pay off the rest, but it's going to be tough to actually pull enough money out when you put nothing down. When you put 20% down, it's better. But
in a lot of ways, this is last week's class where you sell the properties and you tap into the equity and you re-leverage up because you don't have to do 25% loan-to-value for the loan. You can actually do even 20% down for regular ones and another 5% for Nomad. So when you sell them, you get to pop out that whole amount of money and then use that in order to buy stuff. So last week's class on the 3K model is actually faster than what you're suggesting. Huh.
Okay. Yeah.
So. Any final questions? Thank you very much.
Awesome. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nomad Real Estate Investing Podcast, produced by James Orr Real Estate Services in conjunction with the Northern Colorado Real Estate Investor Group. Help others find what you're already enjoying by leaving us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. For additional information, please visit us at jamesorr.com. For questions, suggestions, or other feedback, please email us at jores@jamesorr.com.